Welcome to New World Notes. I am your editor and chief cook and bottle washer, Kenneth Doust. Today we'll feature American historian, lefty activist, and all-around good guy, Howard Zinn. Zinn died 2 years ago on January 27, 2010. We still have his writing and some recordings, though, and his words are well worth hearing. I hope you'll stay tuned. Howard Zinn was a Northeasterner, born and raised in Brooklyn, the child of poor immigrant Jews. His father was a factory worker, a window washer, a part-time waiter. In World War II, Zinn served as a bombardier in the Army Air Corps. Afterwards, he went to New York University on the GI Bill, then on to graduate school at Columbia. After a stint teaching at a black women's college in Atlanta, Spelman College, he ended up teaching for 24 years at Boston University. You want to compare him to his fellow lefty intellectual and neighbor Noam Chomsky, just down the road from Zinn at MIT. When Chomsky speaks on current affairs, you're struck by his large knowledge of modern history and political science. Though Chomsky is not at all pretentious, you can't miss his intellectual brilliance. Answering a question, he'll ad-lib a long, complex discourse that could pass as an excellent college lecture for senior political science majors. Pay very close attention to the full half hour his answer takes, and you'll be well rewarded. Alas, that doesn't lend itself well to radio. Howard Zinn, too, is best consumed in large doses. I think he's best read rather than heard. His celebrated People's History of the United States is well worth reading cover to cover, and more than once. Even here, on first acquaintance, the book may strike you as unremarkable. It looks like a good, solid, conventional history book. The intellectual brilliance here is of a quiet sort. It's in Zinn's choice of what historical facts to report, what speeches and documents and deeds to elaborate on, and what that shows us about how America operates. It's a first-rate alternative history. Alas, much of Zinn's writing doesn't lend itself well to radio. Neither does a good deal of his spoken words. He'll often summarize a lifetime of his research, tell you the main conclusions, without giving you a good helping of interesting historical facts. But sometimes his spoken words are good indeed, and I think we've caught some good ones today. Too bad you missed Occupy Wall Street, Howard. You would have loved it. Here's a nice clip of Zinn, apparently cut from a longer interview on video. It seems to be from the early 21st century. Here Zinn is speaking on a key theme for him, the causes of war. He argues that neither human nature nor the demands of a people lead young men off to war. Rather, wars are caused by the people's leaders, who work hard to persuade the people to go to war. Leaders persuade the people by two means. First, propaganda. Second, coercion, the draft, and prison for draft resistors and other opponents of the war. Keep this in mind as our Iran war unfolds. Here's Howard Zinn.
I always found when in any discussion on war, inevitably, in any discussion on war, at a certain point in the discussion, somebody would say, oh, well, it's human nature. And, well, first of all, from my own experience, and I still have to tell this to people because there are still people who talk about the desire of young men to go to war, the thrill it is for young men to be in war, to shoot their guns, to kill. And I thought about my own experience in the Air Force, and it was very clear to me, looking around at all these guys around me who were dropping bombs and who were killing people, that did not come from inside. It did not come from, oh, God, how good it would be to kill some people today. You know, there was no urge to kill, even though they were the enemy. No, what it came from was simply we had been trained. And also we had been told it's a good war. We've been told we're the good guys, they're the bad guys. It's be bad if they won, it'll be good if we win. We've got to drop the bombs, and so we'll do it, and we'll do it as well as we can. But there was no spontaneous urge to kill. I mean, so that was my own personal experience, simply recoiled at the idea that soldiers have this kind of killing instinct, or the young men have this killing instinct. And then when I got away from my own experiences and just began to study history and history of wars, something else became clear to me, and that is wars don't take place out of the rush of a population demanding war. It isn't the population that demands war, it's the leaders who demand war and who prepare the population for war. World War I, you didn't have the American people clamoring for the United States to go to war. Not at all. In fact, if anything, it was the opposite. People did not want to go to war. That's why Woodrow Wilson, when he was campaigning in 1916, the war in Europe was on, and the question was, will the United States get into it? And Wilson, campaigning in 1916, and knowing that this would be a popular thing to say, said, no, we are not going to go to war. Then he's elected, and then almost immediately he calls upon the nation to go to war. But the nation doesn't respond immediately. If there was a spontaneous urge to kill, why would we need a draft? We would just take advantage of the natural desire of people to kill and give them an opportunity. But no, you have to draft people. Well, you have to do two things, really, in order to mobilize an army for war. You have to persuade them that this is a good thing to do, a noble thing to do. And you have to work very hard to persuade them, because after all, they're going to risk their lives. And so in World War I, a massive propaganda campaign was mounted by the Wilson administration. You know, they hired the number one sort of public relations person in the country to organize 75,000 speakers to go around the country to give speeches everywhere in the country. And the war spirit was built up. And the atrocity stories, the Huns, the Kaiser, really inflaming the public. Only then was it possible to really mobilize the nation for war. So you have, on the one hand, you have the propaganda campaign, and then on the other hand, you have the coercion, the draft, and the punishments. If you're neither seduced by the propaganda nor compelled to go by the draft, and if you resist, you will go to jail. So it takes, in other words, powerful inducements and threats to mobilize the young population of a nation for war. And if you had a spontaneous urge for war, you wouldn't have to do that. And in fact, there's no scientific evidence. I mean, when I got interested in the question of human nature, I would sort of look at the work of anthropologists and zoologists, you know, and I would read, you know, Conrad Lorenz on aggression, and who was, you know, a zoologist, and I would read the work of anthropologists who had studied different groups of people, primitive tribes, as we call them. And it was clear to me from looking at the works of anthropologists, there were some tribes that were fierce and some tribes that were peaceful. It clearly wasn't a universal quality. It depended on the conditions under which they lived. And this guy, Colin Turnbull, wrote books about the forest people and the mountain people. And the forest people, the pygmies in the forest, lived under the kind of conditions which made them violent. The people in the mountains were living under different kinds of conditions, and they were peaceful. So, you know, I just didn't see any scientific evidence. And even when, you know, somebody would, you know, refer me to the work of a scientist, you know, like E.O. Wilson, you know, Edward Wilson at Harvard, who wrote a book about sociobiology, and then he wrote a book on human nature. And you say, well, look, here's a very smart scientist, and he believes in the instinct for aggression. And so I read his book, E.O. Wilson's book, and it was, when I read it, it was very clear to me that no, that's not quite true. that Wilson, even though he talks about a propensity for aggression, says the environment determines whether any kind of propensity that you have is acted out. And also the word aggression is a very ambiguous term, because you can take out your aggressions in many ways. You don't have to take it out by killing people. And all subject to environmental circumstances. So to me, what was clear was that there was a very, very important political consequence of this belief in human nature as the basis for war and violence. Because the consequence of believing that wars come as a result of human nature is to place the blame for wars on individual people, on the citizenry, and to take away the blame from the leaders of the nation who are driving the country into war. So it then became very important for me to knock down, argue against that idea whenever I could. Because it's an idea so deeply ingrained in people, because it's of course, has this insidious effect of turning their attention away from the policymakers towards themselves. It's like telling the poor that you're poor because of your own faults and not because you live in a society in which the wealth is distributed unequally,
I think Zinn was saying, before he was rudely cut off in mid-word, not by me. Zinn fought in World War II, a crew member of a bomber plane. He fought patriotically and without questioning what he was doing and why. What he was doing, mainly, was killing thousands of innocent civilians. Most of them had nothing to do with the enemy war effort. Many of them, Frenchmen, were even our nominal allies. No matter to the generals. Then, as now, they lied about surgical strikes and precision bombings of enemy war plants, and collected another medal. After the war, Zinn began seriously exploring what forces led him to so blithely commit so many atrocities. And in the clip we heard, he summarized some of the answers he found. Above all, he advises, don't fall for the lie that war is an inescapable part of human nature. It's not. In the next excerpt, Zinn says more on these themes, and he talks about current political events. He's speaking in 2006, but alas, the political events are still current. He caught the propaganda buildup to our coming war with Iran. Interestingly, he also seems to predict the Arab Spring of 2011, 5 years before it happened. He begins, though, with the insights of his fellow military flyboy, Hermann Göring.
And you've seen those signs saying, no human being is alien. I think that's true, except for the people in Washington. They say, they've taken over the country, they've taken over the policy, they've driven us into two disastrous wars, disastrous for our country and even more disastrous for the people in the Middle East. They have sucked up the wealth of this country and given it to the rich and given it to the multinationals, given it to Halliburton, given it to the makers of weapons. They're ruining the environment. And they're holding on to 10,000 nuclear weapons while they want us to worry about the fact that Iran may, in 10 years, get one nuclear weapon. How mad can you be? The question is, how has this been allowed to happen? How have they gotten away with it? They're not following the will of the people. They manufactured a will of the people for a very short time, right after the war started, as governments are able to do right after the beginning of an armed conflict. You know, they're able to create an atmosphere of war hysteria. And so for a short time, they captivated the minds of the American people. That's not true anymore. The American people have begun to understand what is going on and have turned against the policies in Washington, but of course they are still there. You know, they are still in power. The question is, you know, how do they get away with that? So, in
trying to answer the question, I looked a little at the history of Nazi Germany. No, it's not that we are Nazi Germany, but you can learn lessons from everybody. In this case, I was interested in the ideas of Hermann Göring, who, you may know, was second in command to Hitler, head of the Luftwaffe. And at the end of World War II, when the Nazi leaders were put on trial in Nuremberg, Hermann Göring was in prison along with other of the leaders of the Nazi regime. And he was visited in prison by a psychologist who was given the job of interviewing the defendants at Nuremberg. And he asked Göring, how come the Nazis were able to get the German people to go along with such absurd and ruinous policies of war and aggression? And Göring said, why, of course, the people don't want war. Why would some poor slob on a farm want to risk his life in a war? But after all, it is the leaders of the country who determine the policy. The people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. All you have to do is tell them they're being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism. It works the same way in any country. I was interested in that last line. It works the same way in any country. I mean, here, these are the Nazis. That's the fascist regime. We are a democracy, but it works the same way in any country. Whatever you call yourself, whether you call yourself a totalitarian state or you call yourself a democracy, it works the same way. And that is the leaders of the country are able to cajole or coerce and entice the people into war by scaring them, telling them they're in danger, and threatening them and coercing them that if they don't go along, they will be considered unpatriotic. And this is what really happened in this country right after 9/11. And this is what happened right after Bush raised the specter of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and got for a while the American people to go along with this. But the question is, how did they get away with it? What about the press? What about the media? Isn't it the job of the press? Isn't it the job of the media? Isn't it the job of journalism to expose what governments do? Don't journalists learn from I.F. Stone, who said, just remember two words, he said to young people who were studying journalism. He said, just remember two words, governments lie. Well, but the media have not picked up on that. The media have gone along. You know, they are having trouble. They're getting desperate about recruiting for the military, going to all sorts of lengths. And, of course, they're concentrating. They send their military recruiters into the poorest schools because they know that the working-class kids are the most vulnerable, the most needy, the ones who they need an education, they need a skill, and so on. And so they're trying to prey on the working class. And Eugene Debs said, if you don't mind my quoting Eugene Debs said in a speech during World War I, which landed him in jail, the master class has always started the wars. The working class has always fought the wars. And of course, that has been true all the way. So we will at some point get out of Iraq. But I want to suggest one thing. We have to think beyond Iraq and even beyond Iran. We don't want to have to struggle against this war and then against that war and then against the next war. We don't want to have an endless succession of anti-war movements. It gets tiring. And we need to think and talk and educate about the abolition of war itself. You see, I was talking to my barber the other day. He said, Howard, he said, you know, you and I disagree on many things, but on one thing we agree. War solves nothing. And I thought, yeah, it's not hard for people to grasp that. And there again, history is useful. We've had a history of war after war after war after war. What have they solved? What have they done? Even World War II, the good war, the war in which I volunteered, the war in which I dropped bombs, the war after which I received a letter from General Marshall, general of generals, a letter addressed personally to me and to 16 million others, in which he said, "We've won the war, it will be a new world." Well, of course, it wasn't a new world. It hasn't been a new world. War after war after war. And I came out of that war, the war in which I'd volunteered, the war in which I was an enthusiastic bombardier, I came out of that war with certain ideas which just developed gradually at the end of the war, ideas about war. One, that war corrupts everybody who engages in it. War poisons everybody who engages in it. You start off as the good guys, as we did in World War II. They're the bad guys. They're the fascists. What could be worse? So they're the bad guys. We're the good guys. And as the war goes on, the good guys begin behaving like the bad guys. You can trace this back to the Peloponnesian War. You can trace it back to the good guy, the Athenians, and the bad guys, the Spartans. And after a while, the Athenians become ruthless and cruel like the Spartans. And we did that in World War II. We, after Hitler committed his atrocities, we committed our atrocities. Now, our killing of 600,000 civilians in Japan, our killing of probably an equal number of civilians in Germany, they weren't Hitler, they weren't Tojo, they were just ordinary people, like we are ordinary people living in a country that is a marauding country, and they were living in countries that were marauding countries, and they were caught up in whatever it was, and afraid to speak up. I don't know, I came to the conclusion, yes, war poisons everybody. And war, this is an important thing to keep in mind. When you go to war against a tyrant, and this is one of the claims, oh, we're going to get rid of Saddam Hussein, which was, of course, nonsense. Did our government care that Saddam Hussein tyrannized his own people? We helped him tyrannize his people. We helped him gas the Kurds. We helped him accumulate weapons of mass destruction, really. But when you go to war against a tyrant, the people you kill in the war are the victims of the tyrant. The people we killed in Germany were the victims of Hitler. The people we killed in Japan were the victims of the Japan Imperial Army, you know. And the people who die in wars are more and more and more people who are not in the military. You may know this about the different ratio of civilian to military deaths in war, how in World War I, 10 military dead for one civilian dead. In World War II, it was 50-50, half military, half civilian. In Vietnam, it was 70% civilian and 30% military. And in the wars since then, it's 80% and 85% civilian. I became friends a few years ago with an Italian war surgeon named Gino Strada. He spent 15 years doing surgery on war victims all over the world, and he wrote a book about it, Green Parrots, Diary of a War Surgeon. He said, in all the patients that he operated on in Iraq and Afghanistan and everywhere, 85% of them were civilians, one-third of them children. If you understand, and if people understand, and if you spread the word of this understanding, that whatever is told to you about war and how we must go to war and whatever the threat is or whatever the goal is, democracy or liberty, it will always be a war against children. They're the ones who will die in large numbers. The war, well, Einstein said this after World War I. He said, war cannot be humanized. It can only be abolished. War has to be abolished, you know. And I know it's a long shot. I understand that. But when something is a long shot, but it has to be done, you have to start doing it. Just as the ending of slavery in this country in the 1830s was a really long shot, but people stuck at it. And it took 30 years that slavery was done away with. And we can see this again and again. So we have a job to do. We have lots of things to do. One of the things we can learn from history is that history is not only a history of things inflicted on us by the powers that be. History is also a history of resistance, is a history of people who endure tyranny for decades, but who ultimately rise up and overthrow the dictator. We've seen this in country after country, surprise after surprise. Rulers who seem to have total control, they suddenly wake up one day and there are a million people in the streets. and they pack up and leave. This has happened in the Philippines and in Yemen, all over, in Nepal. Million people in the streets, and then the ruler has to get out of the way. So this is what we're aiming for in this country. Everything we do is important. Every little thing we do, every picket line we walk on, every letter we write, every act of civil disobedience we engage in, any recruiter that we talk to, any parent that we talk to, any GI that we talk to, any young person that we talk to, anything we do in class, outside of class, everything we do in the direction of a different world is important, even though at the moment they seem futile, because that's how change comes about. Change comes about when millions of people do little things which at certain points in history come together, and then something good and something important happens. Thank you.
The late Howard Zinn. We heard excerpts from a long speech he gave in Madison, Wisconsin, in the fall of 2006. Audio courtesy of democracynow.org. Before that, from a video interview, courtesy of Brass Check TV, brasscheck.tv.com. I have gently edited all the audio you heard. Thanks for listening to New World Notes. Next week, if all goes well, we'll hear from Zinn's former neighbor and fellow adoptive Bostonian, Noam Chomsky. So a toast to the city of Boston, the land of the bean and the cod, where the Lowells speak only to Cabots, and the Cabots speak only to God. But Howard Zinn speaks to us all. And New World Notes speaks to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Illegitimi non carborundum, keep trying to speak the truth, and please tune in again next week. And as my students spell it, C-H-O-W, ciao!